Don't you know we're talking about a revolution? Sounds
it's the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Keith, and here with co-host Gene DiNardo. We're also going to get a special visit today from my brother Mark and his girlfriend Yona in a few minutes, so they'll be joining us. But today is Thursday, December the 27th, 2012. We're at the last Thursday of the year. And Gene, before we even get started and everything, I hope you had a Merry Christmas.
Oh, yeah, it was fun. And how about you, Walt?
It was really good, as usual. You know, how bad can Christmas be, right?
Yeah, really. You get the day off.
Now, last week you weren't able to join us, but I had the thrill of trying to do a solo show, which was kind of different.
Yeah, how'd that go? That has to be challenging.
I mean, it is a challenge, let me tell you. It's a lot easier to have somebody else to talk to.
Yeah,
but it was a good experience. And what I tried to do last week was to talk about some of the basic concepts we've talked about in the past here on the show, thinking in terms of like a year-end summary and a wrap-up. And I was going to do the second half of the show talking about, the first half is about, you know, all the negatives about what's going on with the current financial picture, yada, yada, yada. And then I was going to try to turn it into a more positive thing by talking about what would happen if we were to actually get the kind of economy you and I have wanted to have for quite some time, when basically where there's a level steady money supply and thereby all the consequences that come out of that. And I started to get into it with about 5 minutes left. So didn't get the timing down
right.
Real well. You would think by myself I could get the timing down, but no, didn't quite work that way. So I announced then that regardless of whether I did another solo this week or one of you guys was with me or whatever, we were going to continue on that theme. So today's show is primarily going to be about what if. What if we actually had the kind of economy and the kind of setup structure that we've advocated all along. Before we do that, you had sent me a note that there was a very interesting topic about what's going on with mortgage reduction and the income tax break associated with it. And so I wanted to touch on that first, but then we're going to bypass our usual format, not do the headlines, and we're going to go into, you know, what would be great about having the kind of economy we've always wanted to have. So let's go to your topic first. What did you find out? You said you found a really interesting story about this tax break that might expire.
Well, this is amazing, and it won't take long, but it's just, I kept reading this because I didn't really understand it right, but this is all tied into the fiscal cliff, and there's a ton of things tied in. In fact, the other day I heard I don't know if you noticed some advertisements on TV, and the farmers are pushing, you know, because the farm subsidies are also tied into that. So I saw this one where they claimed that milk would be three times as expensive as it is now, and it's amazing what they come up with. But this is also tied into it, and what this is called is the Federal Mortgage Forgiveness Debt Relief Act. And traditionally what this does, it comes up every 5 years, but this is phenomenal. This is what the tax is. Now, it's considered a tax break, but what the tax is based on, if you are forgiven debt, let's say you buy a house and it's supposedly worth, you buy it for $200,000 and you end up having to do a short sale for $100,000, you are actually liable on the difference in income.
Right.
I cannot believe that. I mean, you must. I guess you were already aware of that, but I could not figure out any kind of common sense thing that would you know, put that in any kind of light that seems like
income tax.
And so the mortgage,
I mean, income tax. How logical is an income tax? So start with
that's
illogical.
That's the premise. You know, we have to start there. But at some point, you have to say, like for instance, let's say they had an income tax and they said we will not tax anybody over $50,000. Once you make $50,000, there's no taxes even on the $0 to $50,000. Obviously, you're going to say that's unfair. Even if you assume that the actual income tax is unfair to start with, you know, and this is just, you know, taxing people on, I just don't get it. How is it income? I mean, you're not getting the money, you know, obviously a short sale, you're not getting anything. The money's going to the bank, so you're not getting that value. You never did get that value, and all you did was commit to paying over 20, 30 years that amount on a house. Somehow, if you don't pay that much, you're liable for income tax. So this could go away.
The logic to it is crazy, there's no doubt, but I can tell you what the logic is, just so that
I'd love to hear it.
The logic is that all these years you've been taking a deduction on your taxes. So that deduction has been piling up, and it's presumed to be on something that had a certain value.
Okay, now, that would make sense.
You shouldn't have that deduction anymore. So
that would make sense if they tax
you back.
Now, do they actually tax you on the deduction, what you've deducted, or is it just some abstract value that you paid for the house and you never sold it for that? I mean, I can understand that. If you've actually taken the deduction, they're saying, well, you know, you have to pay back. But
right. And I can't say in really simple terms exactly how it works, because there's nothing simple about it, as you're discovering.
Yeah, the way it was explained here, I don't know if I can actually, it sounded like you actually, if you sold, let's say you sold your house for $100,000 and you had purchased it for $200,000, that you would be liable for the, not $100,000 in taxes, but taxes on $100,000 income. Let's see, it says, unless Congress acts, all the remaining debt relief to be provided in 2013 under the National Mortgage Settlement will likely be considered taxable income. So it says all of the remaining debt relief. So it's hard, to me that sounds like the difference, but...
There's another possibility that occurred to me. I just realized it. Under another set of federal tax laws, if you buy a house at, say, $100,000, and then a few years later you sell it for $200,000 and you buy another house for more than $200,000, you don't have to pay tax on that increase.
Yeah, right. You roll it over, they call it.
You roll it over. But if you sell it, if you buy the next house for less, then the difference becomes taxable.
Right.
So that may also be tied into this. I'm not quite sure exactly what they're zeroing in there, because the description was very vague. I think it was more the first thing that I described than the second, but it's hard to tell.
Yeah, okay. Let's see. This guy says, this is a quote, people are already suffering enough who go through default and foreclosure, and to suddenly give them a tax bill is incredibly cold-hearted. The government was a major contributor. This guy, let's see who this is, Anthony Sanders, a George Mason University real estate finance professor. The government, he goes on to say, the government was a major contributor to the housing bubble and burst, so it's only fair that it extend the act to help households that have been absolutely crushed by the market. In August, language that would extend the Mortgage Debt Relief Act was rolled into the Family Business Tax Cuts Certainty Act of 2012. The act includes about 50 tax-cutting provisions and was approved by the Senate Finance Committee. Anything I saw in here, okay, let's one more thing here. Sanders said it is caught up in party politics and a debate that now includes whether to amend the mortgage interest deduction tax break, a decades-old law that annually costs the government about $100 billion. Even if an extension to the Debt Relief Act isn't approved by December 31st, it could be voted on in 2013. Okay, it goes on to say, not everyone can benefit from the Debt Relief Act. It covers only forgiven debt on principal residence and amounts up to $2 million or $1 million if married but filing separately. The act also does not apply to second mortgages where the money was used for non-household expenses. So it says it covers only forgiven debt. See, to me that says they're considering forgiven debt income.
Yeah, I definitely see where you're coming from on that.
The other
thing that struck me is when you named it in the article there, what they call the Tax Cut Certainty Act?
No, that's what it was rolled into. Let's see, what does it say? Let's see if I can reference it. Oh,
I just thought that was a weird name, Tax Cut Certainty.
It was rolled into the Family and Business Tax Cut Certainty Act of 2012.
I mean, you actually have to have an act in order to say, this is certain.
Yeah, this is certain.
Really.
Not pretend. So that we would call that the FBTCCA Act.
Well, you're getting into this government swing of things, because everything's done in acronyms, right?
it doesn't mean anything. It should mean something like
it doesn't have
for
to mean
sure.
Anything.
It should spell out for sure.
Yeah, right.
That's crazy. I don't know.
Well, it's appropriate to end the year on a crazy story, because we do a lot of crazy stories, and that certainly fits, it's up on the top 10, I would say. So anyway, let's get to the main theme of the show today. Last week, I spent a good portion of the show talking about the basic concept that my theory is that the main thread that rules all the rest is the fact that we do not have a level steady money supply. And of course, Jake and you and I have talked an awful lot, and Bill too, about how when you have a central authority that is able to manipulate the money supply, almost always to expand it, to basically create this situation where it seems like there's prosperity going on because all this money is being spent, when actually all that's really happened is the money supply increased. And of course, that means over time the individual units, their value decreases. So you end up basically where you were before. And in the meantime, you have a bunch of businesses that are ramped up thinking that business was increasing when it wasn't. Then the money runs out, and then they start laying people off. Now you're in recession. So with that basic premise in mind, it shows that assuming you buy into the theory, I admit it's not something that mainstream economists like or believe in any shape, manner, or form, but I certainly believe it, and certainly what the Austrian economists teach. Once you believe in that theory and understand that money is just as subject to supply and demand as everything else, then it's no great big leap of the imagination to say, well, then what we really need is to have a level steady money supply, because you really need your money to be an accurate ruler. And if it's not an accurate ruler, you can't accurately measure the value of goods and services. So you have to have level steadiness, otherwise you can't trust your ruler. Once you can trust your ruler, then good things happen. So with that premise in mind, this show I wanted to focus on, okay, well, let's assume we have that level steady money supply. What kinds of consequences can we expect to have from that? And just wanted to let you know, my brother Mark is sitting in on the call. And Mark, why don't you just say hello to everybody?
Oh, hello.
Hi. And Mark, this is Gene.
Hi, Gene. Mark.
Nice to meet you.
And Mark is visiting us for the holiday, of course, so we figured this is a great time to get him and you on, and if she wants to get in too, and they can listen in and participate as well.
Sure. Where do you live, Mark? What part of the country?
Dayton, Ohio, or actually Yellow Springs, Ohio.
Okay.
Just outside of Dayton.
So we have the East, the Midwest, and the West covered.
Yep, we just need the South.
Oregon. All we need is somebody from the Rocky Mountains, right?
Rocky Mountains too, yeah.
So let's assume we have this level steady money supply. What are some of the consequences that come out of that? Well, some of the obvious ones I think we can touch on include, if you don't have the ability to manipulate the money supply, then first of all, a lot of what the Federal Reserve currently does becomes useless and becomes actually counterproductive in a much faster time frame than normally happens.
Exactly.
But among other things, it means, first of all, that money retains its value. That would be a new experience for us. I mean, think about that. Money actually retaining its value over time. Right now, we're used to the idea that something that cost, you know, $10 20 years ago now costs, you know, $30 or $40 or $50 or some ridiculous amount, which shows that the money is not retaining its value. But what if the money actually retains its value over time? Well, one thing that would happen is anybody who saves money, they don't lose anymore. They're no longer the victims of the big scam, because now saving money, saving for a rainy day, actually pays off.
Yeah, instead of losing out. The other thing I've heard, and it's actually a saying, but in a growing, expanding money supply, speculation is emphasized, and that's where you, you know, that's where you get ahead through speculation. Whereas
right.
In a sound, you know, a money supply that retains value and doesn't expand or contract like ours does, then the value you produce, the real value you produce, is emphasized, and that's what's valued, because that is what's valued by people normally, you know, and so that's a big difference, I think.
It is a big difference, and one of the areas that shows up most often is in the realm of product quality.
Yeah, that's
something that we've lost track of practically, not only in this country but around the world. I mean, we're long past the day when people valued quality of craftsmanship, quality of, you know, doing a really good job and so forth. Now it's all about quantity. How fast can you pump it out there?
Well, these products, you know, over time, they become worthless. And, you know, they're not only worthless because the craftsmanship has gone down, but because the money, you know, the money's growing and growing and growing. So, you know, part of the reason, one thing I've noticed in industry is they will try to maintain a price point, but because of inflation, what they have to do is offer a more cheaply built and a cheaper product at the same price point. And that's what they do. Like a washer that was, you know, if you went and bought a washer for $400, if you could even do that in the 1960s, the thing would still be running.
Yeah.
So you buy one now, and it's just your standard washer. You expect to get, you know, so many years out of it, but it's basically a piece of junk.
Yeah, it's almost expected that if your washer lasts 10 years, you've made out very nicely.
Exactly.
Where it used to be, if it only lasted 10 years, you're like, what's wrong with that company? So not only under a level steady money supply, not only does the money actually retain its value, but there is incentive to create higher quality products rather than lower quality products.
Yeah, I think that's true. Another big difference is, you know, I see there's two forms of intervention, I think, or two classifications of the government into the economy. The first one is what we talk about, the money supply. The secondary one is laws and, you know, laws that restrict competition and all that kind of stuff, requirements, licensing, anything that raises the barrier, and subsidies, franchising. And if you have a sound money supply, the government's going to have a lot less money or a lot less value to be able to spend influencing the economy. So that's also a plus. Even if you can't eliminate the government from the economy, you've eliminated this source they have for expanding their purchasing ability, and they'll have to do less of it. So they'll have to be more selective, and hopefully competition would increase. I would think it would.
Right. And of course, the Keynesian economists think that that's a bad idea, not a good idea. We should emphasize that fact. They think it's a bad idea because it means that they can't influence the economy like they would want to. So they can't constantly be stimulating the economy
under
the false premise that you have to stimulate the economy if you want to have prosperity, otherwise you won't have prosperity.
Well, you get a certain, got to give them credit, you get a certain kind of prosperity that goes to a certain select group of people.
And it isn't really prosperity. It's fake. It's a prosperity. It's one of those now you see it, now you don't prosperity.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the prosperity of the magician. And once the magician waves his magic wand, it disappears. Whereas a real prosperity is based on actually, you know, being prosperous.
Yeah, and it's, you know, there's also the question of what would happen as far as wealth. And, you know, you get, even libertarians will say, oh, you know, you're going to have to accept that people are going to become really, really wealthy if we had a completely free market. And I don't agree with that. I think the opposite would happen, because if you look at wealth creation now, even in, you know, our controlled economy, there's wealth created when value is created. But most of it, you know, you look at, like, say somebody creates a computer, most of the wealth they actually accumulate from that, you know, a new computer, a new product, a new phone, is from patents and, you know, things that are imposed by the government and restrictions on competition. And so I think it really would be spread out. I think a sound money would, you know, help people who, especially people who tend to, you know, they call the working poor classification, where you're working 40, 50 hours and you can't make ends meet. That just doesn't make any kind of economic sense to me, other than you know, things are being controlled to make that situation, actual condition.
Yeah, I agree with you. In fact, I would say that the initial description you gave, which I think is fairly accurate, there are a lot of people who feel that everybody would have to be wealthy in order for such a system to work. Their formulation is incorrect. The correct way to state that is, if you have a level steady money supply, everyone becomes wealthy. Not that they have to be wealthy, but it makes them wealthy.
Yeah, that's
because the thing that actually happens in a free market, and a free market includes the idea of a level steady money supply, so it would actually be the first time in modern history when we would actually have something close to a free market, regardless of whatever regulations were still in place. It would be a lot closer than anything we'd ever had before.
Mm-hmm.
But if once you have that kind of a marketplace in place where the money can't be manipulated, it is a natural course of events for such an economy to distribute the overall increase in wealth across a wider range, just because the money retains value, so that anybody who saves money shares in the prosperity.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's really the nub of it. Whereas under the current system, the only people who share in the prosperity are the people who get to manipulate the money and thereby suck the value out of everybody else's money. It becomes actually a bad thing to hang on to money.
Yeah, that's true. And the, you know, we look at, like, for instance, the bulk of the financial system, which that's the sector that, you know, profits from this money production. They are, like you say, sucking the value out is a great way to put it. So if that value is not being sucked out, if there's sound money and the only thing that's really rewarded is a sound investment, you know, something you do with capital that actually gives a return, you know, the rest of the value is going to go wherever it's created. It's going to go to whoever's, you know, creating that value, whoever's creating the product, you know, in any form. It doesn't have to be actually on the production line or whatever, but, you know, putting the product together, marketing and getting it out there, designing it, you know, that's where the value is going to go. It's going to go to people who are actually creating value. And I think that's the reason we don't have a sound money supply, to tell you the truth, to get the value going the other direction to people who don't do anything.
And actually, where we're starting to talk right now about this concept of people saving money and not having the incentive to get rid of the money as soon as possible. This is where both the monetarists, including the Friedmanites, the Keynesians, all of the mainstream economists start to have apoplectic fits. Because in their view, if everybody's saving the money, there won't be any economics going on. There'll be basically an ongoing depression because there'll be no trade going on,
which is
not the case.
Totally.
I mean, it's such extreme thinking. If the thinking is, if everybody's saving money, then there's no money circulating. Well, when you save money, it doesn't mean that you save everything you earn.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you still spend money, right?
All the economy is an exchange of what people, primarily what they need. And, you know, that is, you know, the production of the value in the first place is what creates that. I mean, let's say you need a certain amount of food, you're going to go out and do something of value to somebody else to get that food into your house, and that person's going to do the same. And then beyond that, it's what people want. I mean, it's possible that a free economy would produce a ton of leisure time if that's what you chose. You know, so I just think that,
well,
you know, you look at what we're doing now, and people are working, you know, just their heads off, to use a word on radio, you know, rather than the other one. And they're you know, working 50 hours a week, and they can't make ends meet. And, you know, granted, some of them are you know, just don't know how to manage, you know, their finances, but plenty of them do, and it's just not working out. And that doesn't make any kind of economic sense. I mean, it just means that they're doing things that either don't have any value, or somebody else is getting the value, or the value is being sucked out, as you mentioned. And you know, I just don't think that would occur in a total free market, a real free market.
You're right, and that's exactly what does happen when you have this kind of manipulated market. You end up with this crazy scenario where basically people can't survive. You would think after a while, I mean, when was the financial crisis? It was 2008, right? And we've had a number of recessions and dips and so forth over the last 100 years that we've documented numerous times on the show. And each time that those happen, more and more people become unemployed. People try to take on more jobs. They try to work more hours, and they have more and more trouble making ends meet. You would think after this repeated pattern appearing over and over and over and over and over again, the really smart economists would say, hey, you know what? There's a pattern going on here. Gee, I wonder if it could have something to do with what we're doing. But no. It can't be what we're doing. We're doing the good stuff because we're actually trying to stimulate the economy. So it can't be us, right?
Well, just the fact that they believe that they should have that power in the first place just amazes me. I mean, what they're saying is, if we don't do these things, if we don't control everybody's lives, you know, economically, people just won't know what to do. My God, you know, they'll just go crazy and they'll eat each other, you know, they'll kill each other. It's like, it's nuts. I mean, it's a very pessimistic outlook. You know, people, you know, refer to, and, you know, anarchism is, as you know, it's a form of economics. People say, you know, anarchists are crazy. I think most people, you know, they have this view that you have to have this managed system, this managed economic system. They're very pessimistic. You know, they don't have much faith in humans, and it's really amazing that they do, because if you look around, who's doing all the work? Humans.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you have faith in them?
And that's a great point. The current manipulated monetary system where the money supply constantly changes and is constantly increased to suit whatever the central planners have in mind is an extremely pessimistic system. It's a system that drives pessimism. And indeed, that was one of my motivations for doing this topic on the show today, to point out that when you have a level steady money supply, you actually get the opposite. You actually get an economy based on optimism, on hope, on positive thought, positive feelings, positive intentions, positive actions. It's not based on fear. And that's really the big contrast that I think everybody should take away from this. When you're talking about the current economy, the economy we're all used to, it's an economy that's based in fear, based in doubt, based in negative things happening. And, of course, the more and more we have these negative things happen, we get, guess what, more and more negative things happening.
Yeah, I agree.
But when you have an economy based on positive results and positive hopes and positive dreams and positive outcomes, what do you get? Well, you get positive dreams and positive outcomes and positive results. I mean, how much better could it get?
Yeah, I think, and, you know, it does have a lot to do with people in general. If people can't, you know, if they've gotten people to the point, I think through time, I mean, the kings did the same thing. The aristocrats, they all do this thing that, you know, you just can't make it on your own. You know, you need me, even though I really don't do anything. But you need me, and you need my economic system, you know, whether it's the king's gold or, you know, this current one with the Federal Reserve and the central banks. So people, you know, I think they have to really have to break out of that for change to come. I mean, it's not just trying to get rid of these, you know, get rid of this system. People have to take a different outlook and have faith in what they do and faith in each other. You know, I mean, we're doing this stuff. I mean, I don't really understand why a person, you know, would place their faith elsewhere, but they do. And yeah, like you say, it's hope, and it's a positive thing. And I think people have to come to that realization before any great change occurs.
Absolutely true. I agree with you 100%. The one precedes the other, and that's one of the reasons we do this show, and it's one of the reasons why we have to understand if we want good things to happen, we have to envision them ahead of time. We have to know that that's where we want to go. We want that to be our goal. We want that to be our objective. That's how we're going to know where we're going. That's how we know how we're going to get there. If we're focusing on negative objectives, on negative results, well, that's where we're going to get there too. So absolutely right. One other thought that comes to my mind is that the whole concept of central planners, and you were kind of railing up the central planners for a second there, is that they feel, and they really truly believe this, that without them manipulating, without them stimulating the economy and all that kind of thing, the whole thing would fall apart. But really, we know that with a level steady money supply, that would no longer be true. And in fact, most of these economists would have to get new work, which is
actually a good thing.
That's actually a good thing, because what would happen is the economists would actually have to come up with theories that work within the context of a truly free economy.
Or they'd
have to come up with concepts that can actually be applied to help businesses grow, to help individuals prosper, and so on and so forth, instead of worrying about aggregates. Right now, all they worry about is aggregates, the big one being, of course, GDP. You know, and so they say, well, if I can get GDP to go in the right direction, if GDP is going up, we're winning.
Well, Walt, I think
we're all beginning to realize, well, that's not so true. And there are certain classes that are winning, but the rest of us are losing, so that isn't such a good measure after all. But, now all of a sudden the economists would have to rejig all of their thinking.
I think what you're saying is they'd actually have to do something of value to the rest of us, for the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that would be a positive.
That would be a positive.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to recognize that when you make this kind of a change, it's not, people will tend to get fearful about it. It's not something to be fearful about. It's something to say, wow, this is cool. This is good. There's good stuff that comes out of this. Another good thing that we kind of touched on is the shrinkage of government. I mean, you mentioned that earlier, the fact that there's just less of an ability for the government to go deep into debt, to spend all this money they don't have anymore because they no longer have a monetary system that's providing all this money that they can spend, because it's not like they're getting it from the taxes. They're spending far more than the taxes can possibly provide. So now all of a sudden the government really has to do something it has never had to do before. I mean, they're talking about the fiscal cliff now. What they'd really be talking about was living within your means. because the fiscal cliff is really nothing more than we have been trying to live way beyond our means, and now we can't live way beyond our means. Now we have to live only mostly beyond our means.
Yeah, at some point beyond our means.
Right, whereas the new debate would be about, well, we can't live beyond our means at all anymore. Now we have to stop thinking in terms of living beyond our means and live within our means. And now it's no longer a fiscal cliff debate anymore. Now it's a fiscal sanity debate.
Well, that's true. I mean, all the money that is funneled through government, through taxation, obviously not all of it is wasted, but none of it's a product of free choice of people choosing, purchase is the wrong word, but, you take the money through taxation, then you do the project, and a certain percentage of that project, and a lot of times it's, you look at these defense projects and 100% of them are total waste, but, it's always wasteful. So that value is value that's being wasted. It's coercively taken and spent wastefully. And then you have what you mentioned, this money supply that's ever expanding, which provides the other source or one of the other sources for the government. And that's no longer available. And that's just a huge cut. In fact, I don't think we wouldn't recognize it, if it actually happened. We wouldn't recognize the economy or the world. But the question is, and it's a tough one, I mean, how do you get there from here? And that's the tough one, I really don't have the answer. I have a couple guesses, but...
Well, let's take a break because we're about halfway through the show, and then we can attack that after the break, as well as go into some more of the details about what this new economy would look like, because I think it's actually quite an exciting thing to look at. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. Yeah, run back to your dial. Turn it up. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Walt Thiessen with Gene DiNardo and my brother Mark sitting in. And Mark was actually texting back and forth with me during the break there and pointed out that I had written an article on the Nolan chart in a debate I had with our good buddy Bill G a little while back about what would happen if you had a level steady money supply versus the current inflationary money supply that we have. And I was just kind of scanning through the article I wrote that day and just wanted to share a few points before we get into the subject you raised, Gene, about how do we get there, because I think maybe this kind of helps set it up. So let me just read a couple paragraphs that I thought were particularly good. First, I said the limited money supply that you would have with a level steady money supply drives the cost of living down over time rather than up as we've experienced all of our lives. I mean, people today have to work more than twice as hard and twice as long in order to maintain the same standard of living their grandparents enjoyed 50 years ago. And in another 50 years, two generations later, workers will find that they have to work more than twice as hard, twice as long as we have to work today just to make ends meet. And there's no question that, debt-based money drives the cost of living upward on a continuous basis and thereby drives more and more people into poverty over time. And the second key point is that the money that the masses earn for the work they do retains its value when the supply of money is limited. And Bill and I had debated this point extensively, but there's no doubt that when money retains its value, the result is far better for all of us than when it loses its value, because when a worker earns money that retains its value, he gains and retains the full value of his labor. When a worker is paid in money that loses its value, he is deprived of the benefits of his labor. And Mark, thanks for pointing that out, because I'm glad that I reread what I wrote then. That's really a very key point. People are creating value with whatever work they do, no matter what kind of job they have or whether they're self-employed or whatever it is, they're creating value. And when the money that they earn loses value over time, what essentially is happening is the value of what they created is being taken from them, which is kind of what we tied into earlier, but it's a kind of a unique way of looking at it.
That's true. They're actually, paid less per hour, or their salary goes down. And this, of course, is why people are forced to or encouraged to get rid of the money as soon as they get it, or to go into debt, to feel like they actually got the value out of what they do. The truth is, over time, like you said, we're assuming that this inflationary thing is natural, and it's not. Deflation is actually natural, and what we're missing out is this great benefit that we get over time by becoming more efficient, you know, making a product more efficiently or you know, getting food to the table with less work. You know, that's a benefit we all would share. And the same money, I mean, we'd actually, the opposite would be true. The money you earned in producing value, whatever you did for your labor or your time, you'd be able to buy more and more as time went on with the same money. So this prosperity would grow, and, you know, that's why some people say, well, you know, we would have more leisure time. I mean, that's another thing you mentioned in your article, how I think you said 50 years ago, and it's true, you know, 50 years ago, as sexist as it might be, you know, women stayed in the home, and you know, there was one worker in the family and, you know, a couple
kids.
And it
was enough. That's the key point.
Yeah, and that would, you know, they did fine. In fact, as they went through time, you know, at least in the United States and some other countries, you know, they were becoming wealthier and wealthier with the same amount of work. So that's more the natural situation, I think, when people cooperate.
Right, because there's nothing wrong with having both sexes go to work.
Oh,
the problem is when both sexes go to work, and they have to go to work because that's what it takes to bring home what they used to bring home with just one person working. That's
exactly. And it may be that, you know, with a different money supply, you know, an honest money supply, that they might go to work 20 hours a week each, and, you know, spend the other 20 hours with their kids or doing whatever they wish to do. So. Or, you know, they might want to work really hard and save money and retire early. You know, no matter how you look at it, the benefit would go to people, to all of us who are producing, and not to people who, you know, move money around. And, you know, unless it benefits everybody, I think there'd be less derivatives.
Well, I think derivatives would still be around. I want to nitpick one point that you made. You said that deflation is a normal state. It's actually not. I understand why you said that, but it's really not the normal state, because deflation only happens after you've done an inflation.
If you look at deflation, talking about is actually the increased value of, your
saved
earnings.
And I knew that's what you meant. I just want to make sure we're clear about that. That's all.
Yeah.
Because what we're actually talking about is not deflation. What we're talking about is uninflatable money. And that's not the same at all. That's quite different.
Yeah, and the benefit I was mentioning, the benefit from the division of labor, from cooperation, you know, where products actually should become, the same product should become less expensive through time, which is another way the value of your money increases.
Yes, that's much more important. The idea that stuff becomes cheaper over time naturally because of the competitive influence, it scares the daylights out of big businesses that want to monopolize marketplaces.
Sure.
That's why you very often find that it's the largest businesses that are actually opposed to the principles of a free market. They don't want it. They like to have their privileged position, and they know that in a truly free competitive marketplace, they could very easily lose their privileged position. So they don't want that to happen at all.
Exactly. And you know, the whole centralized production and you know, basically what these multinationals do is they take the cheapest labor in the world, you know, China or whatever, and they'll put their factory there, and then they'll ship the product to the most expensive place where people have the most purchasing power, and that's where they make the the profit is the difference. Well, you take away these currency production systems and the different valuations, and basically it gets a lot closer. There's always going to be people who will work for less, but the difference is going to be far less between, you know, because most of that difference is in the currency. You know, Americans get, you know, $30 an hour, Chinese get, you know, $1 an hour or whatever. A lot of that is due to the supremacy of the dollar, and you take that away, you take away the government involved in the shipping monopolies, and boy, these guys are going to have to find another job.
Well, even more than that, I mean, you're touching on a great point here. This is always the thing that a lot of the both the monetarists and the Keynesians point to, that, oh my God, it's this big disparity, and you know, you can't continue to allow that to happen. Well, guess what? When you have a manipulated money supply, that's what's creating that situation. And
that's what creates a disparity, right?
If you actually level out the money supply, you may start off with, you know, say somebody over in Pakistan working for 1/30th of what the same worker in the U.S. would be earning. But that disappears really quickly when the value of money retains its value. The only reason you can keep that pattern going is because you maintain the poverty. You basically, the people who are settling for the lower wage up front stay in poverty, because even if they try to save money, it doesn't do them any good.
Yes,
but once they
right.
can start saving money, even at a low wage, all of a sudden over time, they stop settling for the lower wage because, heck, you know, they've gotten richer. Why should they have to anymore?
That's
There's no
exactly
need
right.
to settle for the lower wage to, just to survive. So now the pressure starts coming from the East to level and raise the pay so that it's equivalent to what somebody in the West is getting. And that's what ultimately, through the market process, through the natural market process, ends up equalizing, or not equalizing, but certainly reducing the gaps in income around the world.
You know, that's true. And you know, people will argue against that theory that the money production causes the disparity in incomes and stuff and wages. But all you have to do is, you know, you say, okay, let's say you establish two factories, one in China, one in Germany. You build a washer. You build the same exact, or you build whatever. You build an automobile. It's the same exact automobile. You got the same machines, same amount of workers. And, let's say they're of comparable levels of skill. What is the value of that car? I mean, to people, if you take away the corrupted money supply and all those values that are created by it, the value of that car is exactly the same. So, you know, from there you can just say, well, okay, how can one person, you know, end up with this much from that and another person in another country? You know, eventually those values are going to come to the same point, and those workers are going to get the same, and everything's going to level out. And that's what happens when you have a sound money, like you mentioned. They may start off, you know, at a lower level, but they get to the same level very quickly.
Now, we should point out that you never actually get the same car. I mean, because manufacturers make different cars, and each has its different strengths and weaknesses and so on and so forth.
Right.
But the key difference there is that under the current system, where you have this manipulated money supply, you also have a strong incentive for having what you mentioned earlier, a system of copyrights and patents that basically moves us away from the idea of people trying to come up with a better product in order to take market share away, and in favor of the idea of large corporations maintaining market share, not based on what they're able to provide to the marketplace, but rather on how much market share they're able to control through copyrights and patents.
Mm-hmm.
And then by manipulating the copyright and patent system by coming up with a new device that has more bells and whistles, not necessarily better, but has more bells and whistles, so that they can claim a new copyright and thereby perpetuate their dominance of the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
But you take away the whole idea of a manipulated money supply, now there's a lot less incentive for people to go along with this copyright patent system, because then it becomes blatantly obvious that it's just a way of manipulating the marketplace to make the rich companies richer. The whole idea of a prosperity coming out of that starts to look ludicrous. And now the pressure starts coming in to change the copyright and patent system, so it's actually more in line with what you and I would call a free marketplace.
And not even to mention that, like we mentioned, the government would have less money, so even if they did have these laws, they'd be harder to enforce. They'd have less money to spend on enforcing them. The other thing is the patent copyright system leads to planned obsolescence, because you take a product like a computer and you put patents on everything, you know, and Microsoft
Absolutely.
Goes out, and when they patent something, nobody else can touch it. So,
right.
you know, these computers become outdated, could easily be altered by, you know, competitor products entering the market to update the actual, the first computer. But instead, since nobody can touch it, nobody can make any kind of system to tie into it and update it, make it better, you basically just throw it out. You know, it becomes outdated, and then you have to go out and buy the brand new product. And so these things are, most people believe the patents and copyrights serve the same purpose that tariffs did, 150 years ago, 200 years ago. So, you know, they're huge in today's controlled market.
Mm-hmm. Yep, they're definitely very large. And the more that we explore this, the more we begin to realize just how dominant this whole idea of a manipulated money supply is. Look at all the different ways that it negatively currently affects us, and how all those negatives disappear. For instance, with a manipulated money supply, you have politicians who are constantly working with the top financial people, trying to gather more and more power into the centralized hands of a few. But when you take that power away, all of a sudden you start seeing a reduction in the size of government, and a government that's less intrusive and basically has to fall back into what would be its correct role in the first place, which is actually defending the rights of individuals who are, wrongfully attacked by people harming them, stealing from them, killing them, whatever it might be. So you actually see us moving more toward what the founding fathers originally had in mind, a small government, not a big government, which scares the daylights out of the politicians and scares the daylights out of the big government people and the people who want us to be the policemen of the world and yada, yada, yada. But nevertheless, it's a much healthier situation.
Yeah, and you can trace the growth of, you can trace the growth of two things, centralized government, large centralized government, and the growth of the control of the money supply, in not just in America, but in Europe. And you can go back, you know, and trace the kings did the same thing. You know, the more they controlled the money supply, the greater, and the gold and the silver, the more wealth they had and the more control they had over people. I think it's more obvious in our, you know, the state, the more modern governments. But you can trace that. And like you said, the beginning of our country, it was much freer. Obviously, it wasn't completely free, but you know, the money supply was less controlled, if at all. You know, and they slowly, grasped at that and got more control over it. And you know, it kind of ebbed and flowed for quite a while. But now it's just so overboard. It's amazing. And you know, they got the centralized governments, but also this centralized system of industry and commerce where, you know, just a few players. I mean, that's also grown right along with it, and I think they go hand in hand.
Oh, yeah, absolutely no doubt about it. The whole thing is all one hand washes the other, and it just has literally taken over the entire society to the detriment of all of us. You know, you asked the question earlier, how do we get there? Why don't we take a look at that one right now? Because that's a question that I think is in everybody's mind at one time or another if they're considering this whole question. To me, the answer is quite simple, and I actually voiced this to Bill a few shows ago, but let me try to summarize again. What I propose is that we don't actually have to immediately go out and replace the current monetary system. We can actually leave the current monetary system in place. Instead, all we really need to do is to get the government to allow competing currencies, particularly currencies based on precious metals, to effectively compete side by side, not to be indexed to the current dollar. By indexed, I mean that there's a fixed value, like under the old gold standard, where, you know, gold has to trade at $35 an ounce or $20.65 an ounce, as it was earlier, that kind of thing, but rather where they're independent. They actually float compared to each other. So you have the freedom to create an independent private money supply, and I can conceive one way to do this would be, for instance, you have a like a nonprofit organization, and this organization goes out and they buy up some gold or they buy up some silver and they make this the basis for their currency, and then they start issuing currency based on whatever they have. So let's say they've got a million ounces of silver or something like that. Well, they can take that million ounces of silver and announce that they are issuing, I'll pick up a number, 1 billion pieces of paper. We'll call them ounces. No, they're not ounces. It can't be that. We'll call them silver slips, okay? So they're going to issue 1 billion silver slips based on that 1 million of ounces of silver. So basically, each silver slip is worth 1/1000th of an ounce. And now everybody knows what the nominal value of a silver slip is. Well, you start circulating these silver slips, and silver slips become the new currency that compete with the dollar. When you have that kind of competition going on, now people can pick and choose what currencies they're going to spend, what currencies they're going to save, when they're going to spend, when they're going to save, what their currency of preference is going to be. Now, people who are opposed to this say, oh, well, then everybody's just going to be issuing their own currencies and it's going to be chaos and anarchy. And I say, no, that's crazy. People just don't behave that way. People don't easily switch over to a new currency. They want to know that they can trust it. They want to know that they can believe in it. So I hypothesize that if somebody comes along and creates a nonprofit organization that issues these silver slips based on 1 million ounces of silver that they've got squirreled away, and they have, you know, certain controls in place so everybody knows that those silver ounces are always there and that they're never issuing more than the amount that they're saying that they're issuing, so that everybody knows what the value of each individual unit is, and that you have that at the same time that you continue to have the current money supply, the manipulated money supply. Guess what? I think right from the beginning, virtually everybody sticks with the current money supply. And only over time, as it becomes obvious to people that the very few people who actually play with this new money supply are making out better, do people start to slowly shift over, because through the test of experience, of having worked with it, of having seen what the results are over time, people become more trusting in it, more willing to deal in it, so that there becomes, quote, more demand, unquote, for it. And that's how you end up with a competing money supply actually playing a significant role in the economy. It's not a case of where everybody issues their own currency and now you have to use whatever currency they issue. No, no, no. That's not the way people work. People will basically say, no, I'm not going to deal with that currency at all because I don't trust it. I don't know anything about it. I'm going to stick with the dollar that I've known all along. It's only after they have the experience of seeing a currency actually in operation, working successfully, and actually working better than the dollar works, that's when they start shifting over. And that's how we know that you won't have a million different currencies issued.
Yes, you're right. It would be selective. And funny you mentioned nonprofit. A nonprofit would produce it, because that's probably true, because any kind of for-profit firm would be less competitive.
Yeah.
And people would select the, you know, if it was a totally free selection, they'd select the one that had more value, and that'd be the one that would be nonprofit, which doesn't mean they wouldn't have costs, et cetera. The thing that I would agree with that. I mean, I think that's a great scenario. The thing that I would dispute it would be that the government would ever allow that to happen, because it seems unlikely. I mean, it's possible they would, but I would look at it as
there's
more,
no doubt the government's going to fight it. Tooth and
what's
nail.
That?
There's no doubt. There's no doubt that the government will fight anything like this tooth and nail.
They're
just going.
Yeah. Which is why I would see more of a kind of originating. The money would originate out of the production of people, and people would, you know. And I don't know how this point would come. I think it's already happened to a certain extent. People start supplying each other directly in some manner, and producing products and exchanging. And, you know, the money supply would come out of that, local money supplies, and eventually would evolve, like you say, the best one would be selected. But
even in that case, it's fair to say the government's still going to oppose it. The government's going to oppose anything once it starts to become popular. Any money supply that threatens the dollar, the government's going to oppose. Doesn't matter where it evolves from, doesn't matter where it originates from.
So it almost seems like it has to be out of the reach of government.
Well, That is ideal in one sense, but really that doesn't happen until people become educated about what it is they want.
Yeah, right.
And once they're educated about what they want, it doesn't really matter where it originates. It doesn't matter whether it comes out of a nonprofit organization or some local currency or whatever else. The real question is, will they accept it because they now understand that they're better off for accepting it? And the more people who understand that, the more likely that the government has to go along with it. Because eventually, if you get enough people who buy into that thinking and say, yeah, this is really better for me, that's when you start getting the politicians tripping over themselves saying, well, I favored that all along.
Yeah, right. The other thing is the need, you know, what they do here in the Western world pretty much is keep people, you know, in different ways, is keep people satisfied enough. You know, they make sure they're not hungry for something different. Because people, when they get desperate, get real creative. And then you take other countries that are more repressive, and what they do is, you know, the people there really are desperate, and they really want something something that works a lot better for them. They prevent that. You know, they have way more fascist controls and controls using aggression and force, keeping people from solving their own problems. So that's kind of how governments handle it. So, I think it's still a tough question, how do you get there from here? But I think any improvement is good, you know, anything. And like you say, education is a big part of it.
Yeah, education is really, I hesitate to call it the silver bullet, partly because of the pun, and partly because there's no such thing as a silver bullet. But
yeah.
It is a very important key, and perhaps even it's the keystone, because once people begin to understand the true value of having a level steady money supply, and they begin to realize that it means so many better things for their own lives, that you start getting a public pressure. And that's ultimately what it's going to take. It's going to take a public pressure based on people feeling like, yeah, this is really the better way for me to go. And once that starts to take hold of popular thinking, I don't think there's anything that will stop it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think that would work in countries that are less repressive. In more repressive countries, sad to say, there has to be, you know, drastic change. I think you're right. You know, you look at that education aspect, and, you know, one of the responses, I certainly don't think Ron Paul was perfect or is perfect. But
one of
the responses I got about Ron Paul from people, no matter what side, you know, whether they're liberal or conservative, was always, well, you can't govern like that. You know, that just doesn't make any sense. You know, it doesn't work in the real world. And, you know, until people can consider those options, you know, options like Ron Paul and people who want that sort of thing, you know, a freer world, it's not, like you say, it's not going to happen. You know, people have to at least understand what he's talking about. You know, basically, most people believe the media calling him a kook. You know, that's what they believe. They don't really understand what he's saying. So until people do, it's going to be a tough one.
Well, hopefully we've achieved a little change in that direction, because unfortunately we're out of time. But let's start the new year off. We'll pick up this discussion again, see where we can go with it, because I think it was a good one. Gene, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Okay, well, happy new year, and to your brother also, happy new year.
Yep. Mark, thanks for sitting in. And happy new year. We'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.